For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Pearlie, and this is the African American Folklorist. During my previous conversation with William Isom and Dr. Nkeshi L. Amin, they shared with us the culture and history of Black Appalachia. In this second episode, they discuss community engagement and regions of the Appalachia. You both mentioned Georgia being part of the Appalachia, and I remember in James Brown's book, which I'm looking at it on my shelf, but I can't see enough to get the name, he mentions in Augusta the interaction and relationship between white and black there. It was more of a kinfolk community, right? What is the race relation that you've studied and observed currently, so from past to present, in the Appalachia with African Americans and white people?
I think there are many, many relations, right? Like when we think about like the stereotypes of the region, you know, we get black people aren't in Appalachia, or they just got here recently, or you get like, this has been a place of abolition, right? We had good white people working hand in hand with black people in the mountains. And I think that, you know, in my work, I think about one, that racism in America has permeated every space. Right. So there was no good slavery. Right. You know, people tell you slavery in the mountains wasn't that bad when they do admit that there was slavery in these areas. Right. It wasn't that bad. You know, the plantations, the topography was such that they didn't have, you know, big plantations, and they didn't have big plantations. They were smaller. Right. But there was no less. Slavery was no less. Right. Or like, you know, or people say like, well, slave owners and their enslaved people, they work together. Nevertheless, you're living in slavery, right? So, like, I think that those things, like, I challenge that in any way that I can. Like, there was no good racism in this region, right? That's not to say that they didn't have, you know, that they weren't abolitionists here, right? Like, they were abolitionists in other parts of the South as well, right? And so I think that these things can happen together. I was reading the other day about this black woman in Greenville who, in the late 1800s, was born into slavery. And then, like, her freedom was bought by the person or was given to her, right? By the enslaved, the master or whatever. And she was able to, like, he had left his estates to her, and like she bought property and all of these things. And in the article I was reading, they kind of credited like her success to the good people in Greenville. And I was like, are y'all serious? You know, like, is this real? Is this real? Like, well, we had these good white people here, so she was allowed to live in the, you know, amongst the elite in this town. And I was just like we have to change that framing. Right.
Yeah, I think that the thing that Nkeshi mentioned is something that I certainly talk about a lot, is that these contradictions are what we're like the good stuff is at, that we need to look at and interrogate. Like, these things happened at the same time in Greenville, in particular, Greene County, which was the home of President Andrew Johnson.
Right.
You know, you did have the first like white abolitionist newspaper came out of that area. You had the Underground Railroad. You had a huge population of freed people of color before the Civil War. You had black business owners, but you also had thousands of people that were enslaved. The people in power were slaveholders. There were people that joined the Confederacy. You know, there was certainly racial violence. There was a slave market there. And so I think these things, even in the most marketable conditions where you can point to these really progressive things, I think you also have the atrocities occurring at the same time. The lynchings that occurred here, we had fewer lynchings, but nonetheless, proportionate to the population, there was still the same amount of lynchings as in stereotypical Alabama or Georgia or South Carolina based on population numbers, right? And right. So you had fewer black folks, but the proportion to the numbers of lynchings was right on par with the rest of the mm-hmm. South. And so I think being able to point these out, that Appalachia is the South mm-hmm. and it's not any different than any other part of the South, except for perhaps the topography and some of the cultural things that occur here. And I think bringing it forward to the future, I mean, to right now, you know, you're talking about to present day, I think you have the same things happening, these two things existing, like white nationalists and Nazis see Appalachia as this potential ethno-state homeland. And so they're organizing here. But then you also have, like, you know, anti-racist progressive folks doing all kinds of really good organizing work and racial justice work in the mountains. The young people, when George Floyd was murdered, you know, the young people in these small coal camps were out in the streets.
Right.
And so these things happen, I think, and have always happened kind of at the same time.
Correct me if I'm receiving this incorrectly, but it sounds like what the both of you just described is, unlike the narrative that's been perpetuated outside of these regions, the Appalachia is not an isolated, marginalized island of its own somewhere. It has the American experience that we've all kind of experienced.
Very much so.
Yeah. With that being said, let's kind of move over to, and we're going to wrap this up soon. I don't want to hold you guys too long. Your community outreach. Share with us this engagement.
That's probably the most exciting and fulfilling component of this work. And, you know, we've, like everybody else, COVID stopped that from happening. So we've not, for the past year, we've not really been able to do the most exciting and rewarding components of this work. And lots of times what that looks like is we don't go into community and start doing work without being invited. So a community member invites us in and says, hey, can you help us do this? And oftentimes what it looks like is we go in and kind of see what materials are available, currently available for a community. And then we, you know, with the direction of community members, kind of see what kind of resources and support we can provide them. And so it can look like a community history day where we sit down with elders in the community and do oral histories for a full day, usually like at a church. You know, we'll set up shop with and have some scanners, and you know, we will get some like librarians and archivists to come in and help us like digitize people's materials and give them their digital copies back and their materials and give them some advice on like how to preserve their stuff. Like maybe you might want to take the staples out of this, like take the tape off of this stuff. Here's some folders that you might want to use to put your stuff in, stuff like that. Because in almost every community, there is an older woman. It's usually a woman, an older woman that has boxes and Rubbermaid containers full of everybody's business in it. It's got like all like newspaper clippings of everybody in the community that graduated, church announcements, like obituary programs, you know, like funeral programs, diplomas, ration cards, all this stuff. So there's usually that one woman in the community that's kind of the caretaker of these things. And so oftentimes that outreach looks like providing her support, because there's a fear that like when I pass, my grandkids are going to throw this stuff away. And so for us to come in and provide support, it validates what they already knew years before. Like it's important to clip these things out of the newspaper. It's important to hold on to these photographs. And so we digitize and catalog them and put them up on our community history database. So that's an effort to raise these things that people have in their basement up to the level of researchable material and value in that. And I could go on and on and on about the community outreach. I'm going to let Nkeshi hop in.
I think the part that I enjoy the most about these, of course, you know, the data collection is cool, but I think this the opportunity to engage with people in a real way, like you know, talking with this lady that is the collector and the keeper of the families of the community's history is also like talking to your grandma or your auntie, right? And they welcome you in that way. At least I feel that way. I feel like every time we go into a community, it feels like family, you know, not to be stereotypical or anything like that, but it honestly feels like family. People are often welcoming. And like you said, we're validating their stories. And for some people, depending on where they are, nobody else does. Like, this is not something that happens regularly, right? Like, their Black stories in XYZ rural place in Appalachia is not, you know, has not been given any importance whatsoever, right? Like, you know, I remember, you know, folks in Mountain City said that they felt forgotten, right? So I just love the fellowship with the people and just like, you know, like, again, we see each other. We see your stories. We see the value in this. You know, we know why it's important. And there are other people out there who know why it's important as well, or who want to read this and to see this and to engage with it and connect with it. Whenever we post something on our social media, you know, we get outpouring of people who are connecting to it, who said like, hey, my so-and-so went to this school, or I see, you know, somebody I know in this picture. And that feels good. It feels like we're doing the Lord's work.
No, I definitely get it, understand it, and live it with you. I have to ask you this last question because you guys just got me really excited with that answer. How important is it to take back, own, and share and preserve what I like to call Black folk narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think about, for example, the funeral programs, right? How something like that is like, you think like, why keep funeral programs, right? But like when our records aren't kept in official ways or organized, right? Or, you know, like when you've gone neglected for so long, like you just want anything that you can grab onto, right? Anything that will give you some insight into your history, into your family's story, that validates you, that validates your belonging, that, you know, like we might say whatever we feel like, but those are real things, right? It's real to feel a sense of belonging to the place where we call home. And I don't know, I just feel like so often our records have not been kept, have not been valued. They fall between the cracks. We have to read between the cracks to tell the stories, you know? So whatever we can find, whatever we can preserve, you know, I can't stress the importance of it and the importance of teaching the next generation that while we are living, we can be documenting, right? So that the next generations after won't have those same issues. Teaching our kids how to like talk to their grandparents and collect the family stories. Like, to me, it's just, I can't stress it enough.
Yeah. And I think also like the opportunity to raise like the value of regular working class, working people.
Yeah.
To like, you know, oftentimes even within like telling Black stories, we oftentimes like highlight the first Black person to do this or the first Black person to do that. Or this person was the president of this college, which is great. We need that. But I think also in rounding out our story, we need to be able to like highlight the guy that was the deacon at the church and worked on a farm his whole life and had three kids and sent them to college. And that's
his life.
That was his life. And that's part of the narrative, too. And I think raising up the narratives of these of regular everyday people, I think helps round out our stories and makes people feel connected.
Right. Right. And then there are more of those people than the you know, the ones that were the first or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
I
it's
totally
good stuff.
Agree.
Yeah.
And I'm actually good. Happy that you both said that, specifically the part about the deacon and the farmer, because we do have a tendency to celebrate those on the world stage when it's the man or woman that lives next door that may just knit a quilt for three people, right? But this is what she's known for. And those three people depend on her. She should be celebrated. I really, really thank the two of you for taking your morning and talking to me about this wonderful organization. Any last words you want to share with us?
Thank you for having us on. You come highly recommended from a banjo player that I know, so I'm really glad we got to meet.
Yes, for sure. And you can find our work at blackinappalachia.org, and we're also Black in Appalachia
Any
on
upcoming
the socials.
Events?
Well, we are preparing for our first Community History Day since the pandemic, and so hoping that we're all vaccinated by then. And May 8th, we're going to be in the Oakland community of Knoxville and sitting down with elders and doing oral histories.
Thank
the new
you
season
listening.
Of the podcast is
I've
coming
been
in June.
I'm speaking with William Isom and Nkeshi El Amin of Black in Appalachia. To learn more about the organization, log on to blackinappalachia.org. For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Pearlie, and this is the African American Folklorist.